Hello, my name's Ben Harmon and I'm the director of Stills, a registered charity and centre for photography based in Edinburgh. You're listening to Photography Down the Line, a podcast aimed at sharing the ideas of artists, photographers and other people from the sector that we're in touch with. For this episode, I spoke to Oliver Raymond Barker, a photographer based in Cornwall who works predominantly with alternative analogue techniques, using photography as a tool to uncover imagined narratives and unseen processes, framed by his interest in culture, ecology, and spirituality. Amongst other things, we spoke about his book, Trinity, which was recently published by Loose Joints. Much of the work for the book was developed in Scotland on a residency at Cove Park on the Rosneath Peninsula. Thank you for listening. Hello, am I speaking to Oliver Raymond Barker?
Yes. Hello, Ben. You are.
I thank you very much for taking the time to do this. Where are you now and what might I be interrupting with this call?
So right now, Ben, I'm in my studio and darkroom, which is in Penryn in Cornwall. So very close to Falmouth for anyone who doesn't know Penryn. And in terms of interrupting, I'm currently planning a show of some work in October. So my studio's kind of taken over by a scale model that I've built of the space, just because I find it really much easier to work, you know, physically rather than on a screen.
Could you say a little bit more about where that exhibition is? And perhaps we're sort of skipping too far ahead by sort of starting the present, but while we're on the subject, whereabouts is the exhibition?
Sure, yeah. So it's in Norway. At a venue, an amazing venue called Atelier Nua, which is right up in the north of Norway in a place called Berda. It's a sort of artist-led photography space, which has been going for a little while now, set up by Marianne Bjornmyr and Dan Mariner. And they've had some great shows there in the last sort of year or so. So yeah, the plan is to show this body of work, which we'll probably talk about later, Trinity, there in October.
Brilliant. And has that been in the planning for a long time? Has it had to be postponed or anything, or is it a relatively recent plan?
No, thankfully, that one's fairly recent. I think we kind of confirmed it was going to happen sort of towards the end of last year, sort of autumn last year. And then there was an option to do it in May, but that was a bit too soon for me just because of other commitments. So this is nicely, this is one that has not been postponed.
And how, obviously you've been teaching at Falmouth on the photography BA, but how's the last couple of years been for you generally in terms of things having to change and be postponed and cancelled?
It's been a tricky time, I think, in many ways. In terms of teaching, I think it's been really hard for the students, you know, particularly say the third year who I just sort of finished teaching. They had a terms teaching. And then that was it. It was locked down. And so a lot of their experience has kind of been defined by that, really. So I think it was tough for them and in some ways tough for us. And then I guess, yeah, in terms of my own practice, it's definitely been tricky. You know, I had a book launch of this work, Trinity, and that was before Christmas. But that was quite often we had to postpone launches because of COVID on the rise. So, you know, a lot of, I think, things which would have happened much quicker ended up being quite protracted. But in some ways it's been positive for me as well, I guess. I was very lucky that just before lockdown, so I was working as a visiting lecturer at Falmouth, but then just before lockdown, I actually got a permanent part-time contract there. So just when all of my sort of freelance work evaporated, I actually had some stability. So in that sense, having the stability of the work at the university has been a real bonus, you know.
Did you find that, we'll talk about Trinity in a minute, but did you find that the lockdown gave you the time that you might not have otherwise had to really focus on that project and developing the book?
In some ways, yes. I guess in other ways, no, because I've got a young family. often the time that I might have had gets taken up by homeschooling or some, you know, those kind of things. And luckily, they're quite young, so the level of homeschooling wasn't too taxing. But yeah, in a way I didn't have that much time. I think what I did have, which was amazing, was actually just time there was definitely times when it was time out from everything, time out from work, university work, time out from my practice, just time with my family, which I think, you know, I think a lot of people found that, didn't they? It was a kind of honing down of your priorities in some respects, which was a positive, even though it had its challenges at other times.
And could you say a little bit about your studio setup? Is your studio in your home, or is it a distance away from your home? And I'm interested to know about Penryn and the sort of environment and opportunities for artists there. Mm. Is it easy to find studio space, and is it affordable?
Yeah. I'm really lucky. So I'm in a studio complex called Gray's Wharf, which is an old wharfside building, you know, down by the river, down by the Penryn estuary. And that sort of got converted in about, I think it was 2017. And I was lucky to get in right from the start, so I could kind of choose my studio. I chose the one with at least windows in it because I wanted it to be a dark room, you know. So it's 5 minutes walk from my house. It's a great set of studios. There's other photographers here. There's documentary photographer Guy Martin is here. There's painters, illustrators, designers, architects. So it's a really vibrant space. And there's also a community interest company based downstairs who do exhibitions and workshops and community engagement work. So in that respect, I'm really, really lucky. But, you know, with regard to the other question of is it easy to get studio spaces down here, it's actually getting harder and harder. I think partly just because of that, you know, that thing of it's Cornwall, any old properties are being snapped up, often converted into, you know, flats, Airbnbs, housing for students, that kind of thing. So, I held out for this studio for quite a long time. I had a space in my attic in Penryn for quite a long time. I sort of had studios in various other places. I was working in St. Ives for a while. I considered having one there, but it was just too far from home. I think for me, that proximity, you know, just literally 5 minutes away, I can pop down for an hour if I need to, or if I forget something, it's really, really positive. But Penryn there's a great vibe here at the moment, I think, in terms of the art scene and culturally. And there is definitely more and more opportunities, I think, in that regard for young artists and anyone really kind of based in the creative industries.
That sounds brilliant. And has it felt like it's perhaps since lockdown, has it felt a lot busier down there? Or have you noticed more people are sort of perhaps studying down there and staying rather than gravitating back to cities?
I think, we definitely noticed, you know, obviously over lockdown, a massive influx in terms of, obviously, it's always busy in the summers down here, tourist-wise, but it was much, much busier. But I think amongst the students, for sure, there's a, you know, some feel, right, I really need to go to a sort of metropolitan centre, London or Bristol or Manchester or Glasgow, wherever it might be. But many of them, you know, they come here for the lifestyle, for the landscape. So they really try and stay and make a go of it, which is great. So there's some really amazing ex-students around actually making really good work. And I think so that, you know, obviously the art college and its history and legacy and its current status, and then also, you know, St. Ives and that whole school and New Lynn, it all obviously creates a sort of particular atmosphere. And then there's a good sort of variety of artist-led spaces. So there's like the Fish Factory, there's another space in Penryn. In Red Roof, there's, you know, Back Lane West, Auction House, CMR. There's a community darkroom in Penryn. There's a community darkroom in Penzance. You know, so these things are, I think, gaining more and more traction as well. Sort of DIY ethic, which is really exciting to see.
I expect we'll come back to this a little bit, but I don't know actually how long you've lived in Cornwall, but has your work changed since you've been there in response to the environment you live in, or have you always lived in that area?
I lived here full time, if you like, since 2010, and off and on before that. I moved down for a while in 2004. I was in North Cornwall, and then I was in London, and then I was back in Cornwall, and I was in North Wales. But sort of 12 years of living here full time. And I think my work, definitely has changed in respect of when I first came down here. I wasn't really making work at the time. I was working in the outdoor adventure industry. Teaching climbing and kayaking, canoeing, surfing, and that had been my kind of way of life for quite a while. But being down here, various things inspired me to start making work again. But initially, I started making work digitally, I think just because it was the most accessible way. But I soon became quite disillusioned with that because I'd never made work in that way before. And so, yeah, after a couple of years of working digitally, I think around 2011, 12, I kind of really made the conscious move some, you know, to analog and more manual processes, which is a big, big element of my work.
Sure, which we'll talk about in a minute. Yeah. You've sort of started to answer my next question, which was how to rewind a bit. How did you sort of get into photography? What was your route into photography?
Good question. I guess it's quite a long and sort of winding path because it's often the way. I mean, I was very lucky. I was able to study photography at A level at school and had an amazing teacher there. He'd kind of worked commercially up in London, but was also really, really experimental and really pushed us to try all sorts of different processes. You know, so he had us using liquid light printing onto, he had me printing onto large, you know, massive old bits of oak wood and using smoke machines to do portraits in, you know, abandoned buildings and, you know, all sorts of just different random stuff. And he would really push us in that respect in terms of alternative process as well. So that, I guess that was kind of what got me hooked. And the fact that I realized, okay, this is something I could actually do as, you know, it's a reality potentially as a job. And then, studied at university at what was then the Birmingham Institute of Art and Design with Deborah Baker, who was an amazing tutor, really sort of, helped me to develop a kind of intuitive sense of seeing, really. But then from that, I left, moved to London and I couldn't really see a way to be an artist. I didn't really have the maturity, I guess, to be an artist. So I got into sort of studio assisting and, you know, worked my way up, started freelance assisting, started shooting a bit of my own work, but it was mainly sort of fashion advertising work. And, you know, and it was around the advent, it was sort of early 2000s. It was the advent of digital coming in with the first kind of phase one backs. So I was doing quite a lot of digital assisting, suddenly spending a lot of time on computers, and it really just killed my passion for photography. So I spent a few years in London fairly soon, got out of there and moved to Cornwall. And that's when I started the outdoor work, 2004, I think that was. And then spent a good 6 or 7 years, Cornwall, North Wales, various other places, kind of developing that as a career, really. So I was training, had various climbing qualifications, which was my focus. And I was working towards being a guide. But then I had a fairly bad accident in 2007 and I was able to still work, but not at the same level I was able to before. So that, you know, was gradually winding down that career, I guess. And then we moved to Falmouth and my partner was doing an art foundation. And she came back from lectures and would say, oh, you know, I had this amazing lecture by this photographer or that artist. And I would just start to take photos again. And that really inspired me to start making work again, like I said. So initially digitally and then gradually analog. I was lucky at the time after about a year to get a job at the Tate as well in St. Ives working as a technician. So that really exposed me to a lot of different artwork and different ways of, you know, making work, different ways of exhibiting work, creating shows. So all of that kind of gradually led to where I am now, I guess. You know, so I left the Tate 2014 and I've been freelance, well, since then, the last couple of years. So yeah, I think that gives you an overview.
Really interesting. And there's always an assumption that people have a sort of clear path into photography with series of sort of logical progressions. But of course, that's not how it in reality really works.
I know, you kind of wish it was like that sometimes. And I guess, you know, for some people it is, I think. Yeah. Often something I try and tell the students is, you know, it's your career in a way is as much of a creative process as your own work. You know, you can take advantage of serendipity, chance meetings, all those kind of things is what can make it for you, isn't it, really?
Yeah. It sounds like you're instinctively a teacher, sort of thinking about your sort of outdoor work you've done, the sort of adventure training and so on, and combining that with photography. Have you always been interested in sort of sharing and teaching the photography as you've gone along?
It's interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's a really good point. I think I guess I had that skill, if you like, and that kind of confidence in, you know, just getting up and talking to a room of people or communicating an idea or an instruction through the outdoor work. and then partly out of necessity, you know, I was like, okay, well, if I want to go freelance, okay, you know, I can make a certain amount of commissions or send them work. But, you know, that whole aspect of working with groups and running workshops was obviously a good source of income, really helped to sustain me. But yeah, I think then I soon realized the value of teaching, you know, like that I enjoyed it and I got a lot out of it. And I loved seeing people get excited and discover new things and find out about the magic of photography or make their own books or whatever it, you know, it was they were doing. But also the value of how it was a reciprocal relationship, which would feed back into my practice. You know, so often for a workshop, you have to develop a new idea or tweak a process or something. And then, so, you know, I find it constantly pushes me to reassess my own work. And I feel like that they're always going to be interlinked in a way. As much as I love just locking myself away and doing my own thing, I feel it's kind of important to get back out and connect with people. Yeah, and share what I'm up to, and hopefully sometimes, you know, it kind of inspires them too.
Yeah, I suppose I'm thinking of the what you've described sounds like someone who's instinctively a teacher, yet I know from your practice that some of the work is very much individual exploration with a sort of backpack just going off and exploring.
Yeah, I think there's that kind of, you could call it a kind of going in and a going out. I really need that time on my own.
Sure.
To sort of recharge my batteries, you know, and that's where I really like to make work. But then going back out and sharing it, either through doing workshops or exhibitions or books or whatever format it takes, is I love that part of the process too.
I want to come on to talk about Trinity really soon, but first I want, or perhaps we can sort of do this as we go along. I wanted to ask about cameraless processes, analog. I know we use the term alternative processes a lot. I'm not sure how you feel about that term, but what it is about those that is so much more rewarding, satisfying to you than digital.
It's a really good question. It's one I guess I still don't know the definitive answer to in some respects. But I think part of it is that I just felt a disconnect with digital. I remember once just pressing print on my computer and the print popping out, and I was just like, I just don't know what's happened between me pressing print and that print coming out of the printer. So there's this physical, bodily, visceral connection that I have to process and materials when I'm working, you know, with analog and cameraless processes. So on a kind of intellectual level, I can, you know, more clearly grasp what's happening, say, you know, chemically, for example. But also on a physical level, it just works for me. And I find it's almost like, I guess what I'm always trying to do with my work as well, and that's why I particularly like sort of alternative experimental processes, you know, cameraless, whatever you want to call it, is I'm often trying to strip away layers of complexity. I feel like often with photography and with, you know, whether in a way, whether analog or digital, there's often, you know, an obsession with technique and process, which is great, and they're often, you know, in my work there often needs to be as well, but then there's also often once I've mastered a particular aspect of technique or process, then I'm almost looking to unlearn other aspects so that I can work in quite an intuitive way. So that's, I guess, that's, you know, certain aspect of why I find it so appealing. And then I always come back to, there's a quote which I've always stuck in my head by Laszlo Moholy-Nagy, where he was talking about how light must be sovereignly handled as a new creative means. Mm. And then he references color in painting and sound in music. And so that idea of light being a tangible, physical material that you're working with is just so, I don't know, that's just so exciting for me. And that when you're working with analog material process, that's when that really comes to life, I think.
On your website, I think you used the term uncovering the unseen, and there seems to me a strong component of sort of making visible some of the hidden processes that go on, stripping back some of the sort of complications around photography.
Yeah, I think that, and also I guess I'm so often aware and frustrated sometimes by the limitations of photography. Obviously there's amazing possibilities and potential, but then there's also this limitations of the mechanical device, if you like. So once you take away that, and also pushing work into different media, you know, perhaps. Actually, I just feel like there's a potential there that I'm really excited by, you know, which working in a very kind of traditional way, maybe just with a set camera day in, day out, I realize the value of that and I realize where that can get you to. But right now, I just, I'm a bit of a magpie. I'm always drawn to something else and something new and in some respects, but it's, you know, I love it as well.
And yeah, we must ask you about your work. So a few years ago, you did a residency at Cove Park in Scotland, which is, for people that don't know, on the Rosneath Peninsula, quite near Helensburgh, about sort of an hour and a half or so outside of Glasgow on the west coast. Could you talk a little bit about that residency and being there? And I think that was that where the Trinity Project sort of started for you?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, for those who don't know, Cove Park is an amazing venue right in the middle of the Rosneath Peninsula. So it's an artist residency space, but they put on all sorts of different events and workshops as well for the community. And well worth looking up. And so, I was really lucky to get some funding to do a residency there. So I think I was not there for a long time. It was 2 weeks. A lot of the residencies are longer than that. But I had a really focused couple of weeks. I'd not long before made the kind of first iteration of this backpack camera obscura. So I guess to give some brief background context, in 2016, I'd been commissioned to make a camera obscura in South Korea. So I made, in the middle of these woods, I made this big sort of 3 meter tall, 4 meter diameter camera obscura for a Biennale. And right at the end, I managed to make some images in it. So I made, you know, really basic sort of shutter, got hold of some chemicals. And that was the first time I made images in a camera. And that for me was a kind of a bit of a revelation of working in that way. So when I got back from Korea, obviously I couldn't bring this massive wooden structure back with me. So I thought, well, how can I kind of mimic that experience, but in a form that's mobile that I can take with me? So I customized an old North Face tent in a very kind of Heath Robinson DIY style with a super meniscus lens and, you know, painting poles of a tripod, all bits of plywood and things like that. But yeah, so I had this camera to test out and I knew I wanted to kind of go to somewhere, you know, wild in inverted commas. Obviously, you know, there's probably nowhere that's truly wild anymore, but I'd come across Cove Park and I knew it was on this amazing peninsula. But then when I started to delve into the sort of background of the peninsula a bit more, what was fascinating was that, this is also the home of Trident, the nuclear deterrent. Mm. And, you know, there's these submarines in the Loch, either side, Loch Long and Loch Goyle, popping up. And there's the whole history around Trident. And then there's also a history of activism there. So you've got locations like the Peacewood, very, very close to Park and very close to Coolport, RNAD Coolport, where they keep the nuclear warheads. And then the other aspect, which I was kind of researching at the time, was also to do with Celtic pilgrims journeying to places like Rosneath in the 6th century to seek enlightenment. And that was kind of inspired mainly by a book by Robert McFarlane called Wild Places. And he talks in detail about these peregrini, these wandering Celtic pilgrims who were drawn to that Celtic fringe of Scotland and parts of Ireland. So it's suddenly like, okay, well, it's a great place to go. I've got a residency there. And also there's all of this amazing subtext, if you like, to the landscape. So I didn't really know quite what to expect, but I kind of went up there with my camera to test it out, I guess, in a way, having made some basic tests in Cornwall. But I was also primed with all of this amazing history and knowledge of the land and what had happened there. So it was an exciting time to be there.
There would have been other artists there, I imagine, perhaps writers, musicians, and so on. Was it quite sociable, or did you try and kind of lock yourself away a bit?
Well, it was great. It was a bit of both. I mean, I was on a real sort of deadline in a way, because, you know, I had 2 weeks and I was like, right, this is really valuable time. My oldest son was, I think, he must have been 3 or 4 at the time or something. So it was a really, I was like, right, I'm getting up at 6 every morning and I'm working till 9 at night. Mm-hmm. So things, I was very focused in that respect. But then there were a lot of other artists staying, you know, from all over, from Scotland, from other parts of the world, writers, loads of really interesting people there. So in the evenings, I did make the effort to go up to, there's a great sort of artist space up at the top of the hill. It's a big, big site and all the accommodation is dotted around in little pods and converted containers. But in the evening, I would make the effort to go up and socialize. And I think that was a really, you know, important part of the experience as well. The staff there as well are amazing, you know, massively supportive. I've made some of the work and developed some of the negatives. You know, I was able to talk with some of the staff there about the work and get their feedback as well. So yeah, it was a really, really positive experience being there.
Yeah, that's brilliant. I'm really interested that you made work while you were there about the location as well. I'm sure that does happen when they have residencies there. And I know it's quite a long time ago now, but Simon Starling made some really interesting work.
Yeah.
Long.
Piece of Xylo Ouroboros.
That's like right. The boat that sort of...
I worked on that actually because that was installed at Tate and Ives when I just started working.
Oh, great.
It was a really nice link in a way, you know, having seen that work and installed it in 2011. I think it was at the Pier Art Centre and then it came to Tate.
And how did you find the landscape and sort of uncovering some of the history that you'd read about? Did you do an awful lot of walking and were you sort of meeting people, talking to people you'd come across or...
Yeah, exactly. I mean, a huge amount of walking, really. You know, that was, I was really pretty determined that I wasn't going to drive anywhere to make work. It was very important to walk everywhere and often fairly solitary, but I did meet some amazing people along the way. I mean, all sorts, ranging from military police one morning who gave me a lift because it was 5 or 6 in the morning, pitch black, and they thought I was a peace camper, as they put it, and they were quite suspicious of what I was doing. You know, I think, you know, if you're an activist or an artist, they're generally pretty suspicious. But I kind of managed to put their minds at rest, and actually that was one time when I was really glad of a lift. They gave me a lift to my location. It was about 5 miles walk, and it was absolutely hammering it down with rain. So that was, you know, one occasion. I mean, another amazing character I met was, I went to Lynn Gardens. The director of Coparks said, you know, you must go and visit Lynn Gardens. So I went there and I took my camera as well because I thought, well, it'd be an amazing place to make some images maybe of you know, of the trees and the whole sort of surroundings. It took me a little while to sort of, I was shouting, hello, hello, trying to find someone. And Jim Taggart, character I'm sure you know of, amazing, amazing man, who was super welcoming and just said, yeah, make yourself at home, you know, you can take photos wherever you want. So I pitched my camera right on the front lawn, sort of outside the house, because in a way that was the only bit of grass sort of big enough where I could actually pitch it. And I took 3 or 4 exposures of the canopy there. And one of the images in Trinity actually is a kind of bright blue, shocking bright blue image, is of those gardens. And then afterwards Jim was like, oh, come into the house, you know, you must come in and have a cup of tea. And it was an incredible experience. I mean, the house was a beautiful old house, but you know, he lived in in a chaotic manner, you know. And but we sat in the kitchen and I drank about 10 cups of tea, I think, a cheese sandwich. And I was in there for about two hours, I think, maybe more, before eventually sort of managing to having to drag myself away. But it was an amazing experience. I mean, he was telling me all about his son, and a very sad story about his son. Mm. He was a botanist as well and a plant explorer, I guess you would call him, you know, and had gone missing a few years previously whilst exploring in the Middle East, I think it was somewhere. So that was an amazing experience. And then just, I guess, the other thing that was very interesting was just talking to, say, the cleaners or all the different people who worked at Cove Park, around Cove Park, because, you know, it might be that their husband or their partner or their nephew worked at Faz Lane, you know, the military base. So it was really interesting to get all of these sort of contrasting perspectives on the peninsula itself, and then also on the presence of that nuclear presence there, you know?
Yeah, sorry about the doorbell ringing in the background, by the way.
That's all right. But,
yeah, I imagine it, and I imagine it's not at all as straightforward as sort of us and them, but there will be, yeah, like you say, sort of personal family connections between people in peace camp, people in the base.
I think that's often, the problem with these kind of situations is it kind of can end up really polarizing opinion and being very divisive. And even though I do have an opinion, and I am on a certain side, if you like, often when that becomes extreme, it just doesn't feel like it's actually particularly progressive or it's actually helping the issue. And that's something I really didn't want to sort of, I didn't want to, you know, it wasn't like I was going to make an overt documentary saying, you know, Trident is here and this is the issue and this is bad and this, you know, I kind of wanted it to be quite open, really. People can approach it hopefully in their own, with their own opinion and their own background and their own knowledge.
Sure. And so this work became the book Trinity, which could you say a little bit about that? You published it quite recently. Did the project sort of continue once you'd left Cove?
Yeah. So I left, and whilst I was there, actually, I got chatting with the education officer there, and she was really keen that I come back and do some workshops around camera obscuras and things. So I did go back the following year, which was great. So I managed to make some more work then. I think that was early 2019. And then, yeah, I kind of got to a point of thinking to kind of pull all this together, to pull all these multiple strands of thought together. I was like, I can't see how to do this, you know. I'm not sure what the vessel or the vehicle is for the work to sort of go out there. And so in the end, the idea of a book just seemed like a way to be able to draw together all these disparate strands of narrative. And I got recommended Loose Joints initially Lewis Chaplin as a designer. So, you know, I went to Lewis with the project and he was interested to work on it. Him and Sarah were keen. So they worked on that. And, you know, we worked on that for a period of 6 months or something, and then made a small amount of book dummies. That's quite a while ago now. I think that was beginning of 2019. I think we made something like that, March 2019. We made the first dummies and submitted it to a few of the, you know, the dummy awards, etc. And it got a bit of recognition. It was shortlisted for Cassell, which was great. So that meant it traveled around a bit. And then I was looking to get it published and sort of starting to talk to various people. And then Lewis said, well, you know, why don't we publish it? It kind of makes sense. And so that was a great way forward for it, I think, because they had designed it and it's quite a specific design in a way. So I think if it had gone to a different publisher, maybe, you know, we would have had to start from scratch again. So yeah, so they published it and it was launched just before Christmas last year.
Yeah, I've not had a copy in my hands, but I know from your website, which is oliverraymondbarker.co.uk, I should just point out to everyone. It's a really beautiful object. You know what?
Get a copy, up to you there.
Actually, we'd love one for our library. Thank you.
Yeah, definitely. Fantastic. Yeah, I'm really keen. I think that's something as well that I'm really keen as much as possible, because it's a handmade book. There's a lot of labour that goes into it. So, you know, it's £70, which is obviously not that accessible. It's quite an expensive book in some respects. So I'm really keen that as many copies are out there as possible for sort of public reference. So there's a copy at Reference Point 180 in central London, an amazing sort of open library for arts reference. There's a copy at V&A, National Art Library now. So to have a copy in Scotland would be really great. Obviously, it's where the work is from. So it, you know, it needs to be there as well.
Yeah, we'd love that. Thank you. Yeah. How did how did you come across Nick Hunt and ask him to write the text for the book?
I'd known Nick for a little while because of his involvement with a project called Dark Mountain. So Dark Mountain is a kind of loose collective of, I guess you'd say, like writers, artists, thinkers. It was set up I don't know how long ago, actually, probably 2000 and I can't say off the top of my head, like 10 odd years ago, maybe something like that, set up by Paul Kingsnorth and Dougal Hine. And Nick is an amazing writer. He's written a stunning book, which I'd read, called Where the Wild Winds Are, which is well worth reading if you get a chance. And he was the arts editor for Dark Mountain. So I knew him because he'd published a few different bits of my previous work in the anthologies that Dark Mountain publish. So I emailed him and said that, you know, I've got this project I'm working on. I'd love to have a creative text to go with the work in the book. I'm kind of working on one myself, but I'm not a writer, so I could really do with someone who is. Would you be interested? And he came back, and he was really keen. And what was amazing was this kind of amazing synchronicity, which I didn't know about, was that he had been an activist on the peninsula in 2002.
Oh, right.
And he stayed in the Peacewood, and he had swam out into the loch in front of submarines as part of a direct action. Just kind of made absolute sense that he knew the landscape where I was working intimately, you know, even better than me. He had this really close connection with that aspect of the story. So then he wrote this amazing three-layered narrative, which is in the book, and which sort of takes in his own personal experiences as an activist. It also imagines a Celtic monk arriving there, St. Modan, in the 6th century, and also sort of has another level, which is almost from the submarine's point of view. It's quite sort of oblique, abstract text that kind of puts that submarine into the mix as well. So yeah, it was a really lucky and fortuitous connection, really.
And that text is on your website, isn't it? People,
yes, yeah, it's all there. Full text is there to read. Yeah,
I'm curious to know if there are any particular artists or photographers or other sort of cultural reference points that have informed this work, or maybe inform your work generally, that you maybe return to.
Yeah, sure. I mean, like I mentioned earlier, I think Robert McFarlane and his book Wild Places, I would say, was a sort of key inspiration for this work and for a lot of my work. And his new books as well, Underland, is an amazing one. And I'm kind of, we can mention it briefly later maybe, but I'm working on a new project. I went down a silver mine the other day and I was really thinking of him, underground expeditions. So yeah, and then also Dark Mountain, which I mentioned. Yeah. So they're a really interesting group of writers and artists. Nick Hunt being one of them, but also Paul Kingsnorth and a lot of the people who contribute to that. In terms of, you know, photographers and artists, I guess there's the whole alternative analog kind of crowd, if you like. I mean, there was a show at the V&A that I saw 2010, I think it was Shadow Catchers, created by Martin Barnes, which, you know, had Gary Fabian Miller, Susan Dirges, Pierre Cordier, Adam Fuss. That whole crowd of photographers has been massively influential. And then also people who work, I guess, in, you know, directly with camera obscura, so people like John Chiara, Vera Lutter, Abelardo Morel. I sort of felt like when I started to work with camera obscuras, I was very aware I didn't want to just repeat their process. Yeah. Something I always try and do is map out, okay, what's happened here before? How is my work maybe slightly different, or how does it add to the conversation?
Yeah. I was thinking of Thomas Joshua Cooper's work and wondered if you're familiar with that. Mainly, I suppose, thinking of this idea of the photographer as a sort of explorer, someone sort of documenting these, some of the most remote and extreme sort of parts of where the land meets the sea. But also he has been working on a recent project about Celtic saints, and I think some of that's been exhibited.
Really, but I love his work. I haven't seen that Celtic saints work, so I'll have a look. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, I have a feeling some of it was exhibited in Inverness this year or last year, but I didn't see it. But that's a really interesting list of people you've mentioned. I'll include some of those in the episode notes as well. In the interest of time, just to sort of move things on, I know there's a lot you've worked on other projects too, which I'd love to have time to ask you about. But what are you, could you say a little bit about what's next? You've mentioned the exhibition in Norway. Are there other things in the pipeline?
There's a couple of things, you know, the finishing off Trinity in a way is taking up the majority of my time at the moment. But really, there's two things I want to work on. I'm calling it coastal obscura at the moment. which, you know, is just a sort of working title in my head, but it's this idea of swimming different bits of the Cornish coast and towing probably the Premature, yeah, but also taking other kind of recording media, whether that's like audio or whether that's a GoPro or, yeah, and swimming into these coves, which are generally tidal and often not accessible on foot, and spending some time there exploring the coves and the caves, and also sort of exploring the mythology and some of the histories that, you know, are embedded in those landscapes. So, I mean, it's quite an exciting, I always think, you know, it's a really exciting time because it's a brand new project and it's wide open and there's no limitations at the moment. So that was something I'd hoped to start working on this summer. I don't think I'll actually probably make that much work, but I think I'll try and do quite a lot of recceing in August. So just swimming the coast and checking important things like access and states of tides, heights of different tides, all that kind of stuff, so I can do it,
yeah,
kind of safe, in a safe manner. So there's that, and then I'm also working on a project, a kind of research project as part of my work at Falmouth to do with silver. So I'm collaborating with some academics from Exeter, so a professor in sustainable mining, or two academics in sustainable mining from Exeter, and someone from the arts and humanities, and we're looking at the element of silver. They're doing a specific project which is to do with tech metals, you know, so things like, you know, lithium, cobalt, but also included in that are platinum and silver, which obviously can be used in photographic processes, so kind of particular interest to me. And they're looking at circular economies and ideas around that, and so I'm really keen to kind of basically collaborate with them, and we're looking at lots of different ideas, but one is, you know, this idea of actually often when we buy film, when we buy paper, we don't know where it comes from, we don't know how the silver was processed, we don't know who processed it,
yeah,
what conditions, and so we're quite excited to try and make at least one print from some ore that's been sourced in Cornwall. So we visited a silver mine on Monday. I mean, it's a very old silver mine that's now, you know, hasn't been worked for 200 years in North Devon. But there is still, you know, tailings there, lumps of ore-bearing silver. So we're going to get some samples from there and look to refine the silver, make some prints, and various other ideas there as well. So we'll see how that goes. It's kind of a long-term project.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for talking to me. I really, really appreciate it. It's really, really good to hear you talk about Trinity and your work. And yeah, do let me know if you're up this way at any point.
Yeah, I will do. Definitely do a trip to Scotland soon. Yeah. I will let you know and I'll drop in.
Well, thanks again. And look forward to seeing more of your work soon.
Brilliant. Thanks, Ben.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye now.
You've been listening to Photography Down the Line and my conversation with Oliver Raymond Barker. If you're interested in more episodes, this podcast is hosted by Anchor and can be found via most podcast providers. Thank you for listening.